Hi, I'd like to speak with the Director of Artist Development and Promotion, Video Department, please.
So would I. No, I'm kidding. Mo Fuzz, President. What can I do for you?
Sir, my name is Ivan Alexey.
So you want to make videos for Mo Fuzz? What kind of equipment do you got?
Top of the line. We got our own studio.
Hold my calls.
I brought in a reel of our work. It's a little rough around the edges, but I believe that it captures the energy of our company and shows...
I don't need to see it to know I'm already crazy about it. I've got a sense about you, an instinct, and I've got just the band. Cube squared. This group is hotter than hot. They've sold more records in Sweden than ABBA. Let's get into trouble, baby.
Welcome back to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Let's get into some trouble, baby.
Also joining this week is Charm City's very own Skiz Sizek.
Hey!
This week, we're looking at the 1988 film by Bill Fishman, Tapeheads. This film tells the tale of Josh and Ivan, played by Tim Robbins and John Cusack, two losers stuck in a dead-end job as night security guards. They have aspirations of making it big. Josh has got the talent and Ivan has got the mouth. They get into video production, making commercials, taping psychic sessions, doing video wills, and finally making it big in the music video business. The boys catch a lucky break when one of the bands they shot gets hit by some space junk and their video gets heavy airplay on RVTV, the music video channel. This inadvertently gives them the chance to help out one of their favorite bands, the Swanky Modes. So Justin, just why did I pick this movie?
That's a great question. Why did you?
I enjoy this movie quite a bit. It speaks to me immensely, as I was kind of in the video business way back in the day. Not at the same time that this movie is being made, but I was trying to get into the biz, trying to shoot some music videos and those kind of things. And failed miserably. So Josh and Ivan were kind of an inspiration to me. This really, to me, it captures perfectly that time of when MTV was big and when folks could make it and could actually pick up a video camera and go out and shoot stuff and actually be successful, when you could make a living by going out there and shooting wills and weddings, you know, especially weddings, for God's sakes. That was, you know, I knew a lot of folks back in the day that were weddings videographers. And would go out every weekend, man. And it was kind of a new deal back then to have a videographer at your wedding. I guess before that, you would just have Uncle Maury with a 16 camera or Super 8 camera out there shooting your stuff. So this really captured those days of when MTV actually still showed videos. Justin, do you remember music videos?
Michael, you're only like a couple years older than me. And I actually have a huge, huge archive, about 20 hours of music videos. And I also have about 30 episodes of MTV's 120 Minutes on DVD. So yes, I'm very well versed in music videos.
Now, are those the Dave Kendall 120 Minutes or the Kevin Seal 120 Minutes? Or, God, wasn't there another host to 120 Minutes for a while?
Yeah, there was Matt Pinfield. There was Dave Kendall, Kevin Seal.
Matt Pinfield.
Kennedy, I think, too. Was 93, 94. Remember her?
Yeah, how can I forget Kennedy?
Yeah, wow. Exactly.
So, Skiz, you are actually a music video, you know, you've done music videos for bands, some like legitimate bands in the past, right?
Yeah, I'm a video ace.
Wow, nice. The one thing that really kept me out of the music video business was the only bands that ever approached us for doing their videos were bands I didn't like. Have you ever run across that problem?
That comes with the territory. If you want to make money, you have to take whatever jobs come your way. But the best way to do it is to go out and find the bands you do like and approach them.
Who are some of the bands that you've shot videos for?
I've worked with Beach House, Meat Jack, Young Fresh Fellows, The Moners, Mad Tea Party, Tippy Canoe. The Jennifers, Berserk, Blister Freak Circus.
Ah, very nice. Yeah, I heard those Jennifers, they've got a new album even out.
Yeah, it's really good.
Very cool. Justin, I left you a little homework this week to come up with your five favorite music videos.
I can tell you my list is going to destroy the both of your lists.
Do you want to go first or last?
You know, I'll go last. How's that?
All right, all right. Skiz, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Since I never had cable and didn't really watch MTV much, I don't have favorite music videos. I do love those compilation DVDs of Michel Gondry and Spike Jonze. I got to admit, I really like those OK Go videos that keep popping up online, even though I don't care too much for the songs.
Yeah, the songs really aren't that much, but the videos are pretty cool. I do like the treadmill video quite a bit. I will go ahead and I'll say that mine, I'm also a big Spike Jonze fan, so I do love the Buddy Holly video that he did for Weezer. It was tough when I was thinking about this, whether to choose that one or Sabotage that he did for the Beastie Boys, but I think you know, Skiz, more than anybody, what a big fan I am of Happy Days, so I had to go with the Buddy Holly video. Yeah, and then I love Sugar Water by Chibo Matto. I don't know if you guys have seen that one. Yeah, where it's like two stories, split screen thing, where one story is going forward, the other story is going backwards, and the kind of one ends where the other one begins, or they end in the middle, I think. I love the video for Little Girls by Oingo Boingo. Again, it was kind of tough on that one, whether to choose the Little Girls or Private Life, because I remember seeing Private Life on Night Flight forever ago and just being completely blown away by it, because even though it was a music video, it was very different than anything I was seeing on MTV at the time. You know, MTV was playing Jump by Van Halen, and Night Flight was playing Private Life by Oingo Boingo. So it kind of describes where their audience was. Being Completely Lascivious, I love the video for Who's Your Daddy by Benny Benassi. I don't know if you guys have seen that one, but it pays homage to all of these classic porn posters. So like as they go through the video, they're constantly like ending up in poses where it looks exactly like an old porn poster, and they'll have like fake names and stuff for these films. So rather than The Man Who Loved Women, it was, you know, The Man Who Loves All Women and stuff, and they have the exact same image up on screen. Very cool. And then I'm a big fan of talking about like cheesy stuff and kind of going back to Jerry Todd. We're talking about Rick Moranis for our Streets of Fire episode. I'm a big fan of Top Secret Man by The Plastics. I remember seeing that on SCTV way back in the day. I never saw that one on MTV or Night Flight, but I do enjoy that one quite a bit. Go ahead, Justin, destroy us with your list.
I stayed painfully proper in this homework assignment in the sense that I chose videos that I like from the era of 87 to 89.
Wow, nice.
The first video, and I don't, this is not a top five for me since I'm not going to list them in order, which is the best one. I'm just going to give you five that I really like. And that's, the first one is the Beastie Boys video for Satarachi, which was on Paul's Boutique Sub. It's the crazy like pastel animation when they're on stage. It's amazing. It's, you know, Satarachi's Grace has got that Sly Stone Loose Booty sample running through it. So that came out in 1989. Then I have, of course, which is kind of an obvious one, I have chosen Metallica's One, which is a fabulous video, very great for the song. You know, if you remember the video, it's got the Dalton Trumbo Johnny Got Your Gun bits with Tim Bottoms in it. And then I chose 1988's Dead Milkman, Punk Rock Girl.
Very nice.
Which is, you know, works for itself. And then I chose, I went kind of risky. I had a toss up between Danzig's She Rides, and which came out in 89, and then Dad I'm in Jail by Was Not Was.
Oh, I love the Dad I'm in Jail video.
I'm burning you, son. I'm burning you right now. All right. And then the last social comment of the 80s music video, Genesis, Land of Confusion, 1987.
Wow. Nice.
Ooh.
Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah. This is a 4 a.m. list, by the way. I'm just letting you know. And I did watch them on YouTube at 4 a.m. this morning in prep. I mean, technically, the song came out in November of 86, but that video was just in such heavy rotation in 87 MTV, I figured it was just fine for the list.
Hey, so. No problem. No problem. Good. You know, one of the things that we're going to find out here in a minute is just all of the problems that this movie had coming out in 1988. It was shot in 88, kind of came out in 88, kind of came out in 89. It was one of these victims of the De Laurentiis bankruptcy. This week, we were lucky enough to talk to director Bill Fishman and producer Peter McCarthy. Both of these guys wrote the screenplay. Play. Let's go ahead and roll the interview, and then we'll be back to discuss Tapeheads more in depth. Peter McCarthy.
Repo Man was the first film I did. Went to UCLA graduate school where I met Alex Cox and Jonathan Wax. I kind of had a little office that I'd set up in Venice, and Jonathan said, hey, I need an office, so we start sharing it, and we sort of start working together on stuff. And then Alex said, hey, you have an office, let me come in too. And so we started a company called Edge City, and we had one other member of the company, a guy named Bob Rosen, who's a professor at UCLA, who chipped in some money. And we started this company and, you know, tried to make films. After a three-year try, we got lucky with Repo Man. I was a producer on it with Jonathan, and Alex was the director, and he was the writer. And, you know, we kind of shepherded it through, Alex did a draft, and then the draft originally, a much, much bigger project where, you know, leaves L.A. and goes to New Mexico, and it was quite episodic, so we decided to make it all L.A. So we worked on it a long time, and man, we sent it out to everybody. And finally, Terry Gittes, he's a great producer and a great guy, and he had read the script, and we knew him through a personal connection. I think it was Abby Wool's mother. Abby Wool was the writer of Sid and Nancy. You know, she introduced us to him, and then he turned it on to Michael Nesmith. And Nesmith, I think at that point in time, was going through major financial upheaval. He had just had his Rolls repoed out of his driveway. So when he got a script that said Repo Man, you know, I don't even think he read it. He just went, oh my God, I got to try to make this thing. So he came in as executive producer, and, you know, his fortunes also took an upturn at that point in time too, because his mom invented liquid paper, and I think they sold it to like 3M or, I don't know, some Scotch Guard or something. They sold it to somebody and made like tens of millions of bucks. Repo Man, it ended up being a negative pickup for Universal. And I remember doing a screening at Universal, and they saw it and their jaws dropped. I mean, they just had no idea they didn't think it was funny. They really disliked it, the administration there. And it was a guy named Bob Ramey had been the president when they did the negative pickup, and then he got canned, and I forget who came in. And so Ramey kind of was a New World kind of guy, and he, you know, he was into developing really small films and developing filmmakers. You know, Universal really is not the place for small films. I mean, that the budget of our film wouldn't pay for the toilet paper in the tower there. So they just didn't get it. They didn't get the humor. They didn't get any part of it. And they just wanted to bury it, so to speak, put it out on video. But what's interesting is the soundtrack. We did a soundtrack. I kind of shepherded a soundtrack through Kathy Nelson, who, you know, was like a really major, major soundtrack person now. But back then, she was a major player in a way, but she was starting out in soundtracks. And we put it together, and what's his name? Isaac, I can't think of the guy who was the head of Universal Music then, but one of the big luminaries. And he said, like, what the hell's going on here? We've sold like 50,000 of the soundtrack. What is Repo Man? And she went, well, it's a film. And he goes, well, where is the film? And she said, well, it never got released. And so he finally got it to get released through special handling. And when it got released through special handling, and a guy named Kelly Neal got it, played for like a lot. It played for over a year in New York at like the 8th Street Playhouse. It played in certain venues forever. And in some ways, you know, the powers that be who had stifled it were sort of getting their comeuppance in a way, and they really disliked it, what was happening. And so it didn't do great theatrical. It probably did like 3 to 5 or 6, but, you know, for a film that only cost $1 million, it was pretty amazing. And seeing that there was no P&A at all, you know, they were just shipping prints around, and, you know, Kelly Neal, you know, who had special handling up to then used to do like re-releases of Hitchcock films. That was their big, you know, that's what they did. And so suddenly they had Repo Man, and they were like, we're going, holy Christ, you know, what's going on here? We've never had a film play for a year in one theater. So, you know, it started creating this kind of cult sensation at that point in time. Unfortunately, it didn't translate into gold, but we did get some notoriety, and it's a great film.
Bill Fishman.
I started out at a film school at American Film Institute, and at that time, you know, when he came out, there wasn't that much opportunity to get into film. We didn't have whatever, DSLRs or iPhones, you know, to shoot with. So it was kind of a long process of trying to get into the studio system and start as an assistant. And so I started, doing assistant camera and gaffing and grip and anything I could on short films. And I got a job on a music video. I think it was Tim Carnes back then. Remember, like, Betty Davis eyes, and I think I think it was like Kim Carnes, and you know, basically, I felt that some of the directors I was working with, you know, I didn't know if I could do any better, but I felt like, you know, I couldn't do any worse. So I decided to start my own little music video company, because, you know, you could just do it. There was no barrier to entry, so to speak, you know. And I sort of trolled around and looking for bands that could, MTV was just starting, and bands to give me a shot. And the first one that I actually did was called The 3 O'Clock. We did a song called Jet Fighter Man. And the label, small label, had another band called Suicidal Tendencies. They had a track that was on K-Rock that was just kind of blowing up. It was a punk song called Institutionalized. So I said, sure, I would do Institutionalized, but they didn't have much money, and I was looking around for a way to get a little more money to do the video, and it was in a film called Repo Man. So I found some contacts to Peter McCarthy and Alex Cox and guys that were doing done Repo Man. It wasn't released yet. And I said, hey, you know, we got some money to do Institutionalized, and we can promote your film and maybe get money from Universal, who's releasing Repo Man. And he said, yeah, that's a great idea. And so he went to Universal. The guy who was releasing it at Universal was like one guy with the independent department there at that time. And he was like, yeah, this is a great idea. You know, let's do it. It's fantastic. And I said, okay, so how much money are you guys going to put up? And he said, nothing. And I said, oh, okay. So I went back to Pete and said, hey, Universal really wants to do it, and they don't want to put up any money. And so he said, well, fuck them then. Just, you know, don't put any of your film in it, and just do it yourself. So I ended up, doing the video myself. But I met Pete, told him I had an idea for a movie I'd been writing, and it was called Tapeheads, and that's how that started.
Peter McCarthy.
After Repo Man, Bill came to see me when I had my little office. I'd heard of him in a way because he'd done a video that I liked. And he came in and we talked, and he brought me this. He said, oh, I have this idea about videos. And, you know, he was a video director who I admired. And, you know, we did the Suicidal Tendencies videos. I thought they were incredible. And I got, he's a video director and he has a film about videos. I'd like to get involved.
Bill Fishman.
I was working for another production company as a PA and editor and shooter and whatever else I could do. I had an idea for a movie about that scene that was sort of happening in L.A. and that I had been involved in. And, you know, it was called breakdancing, you know. I told the guys at the company, hey, I want to do this movie about this new phenomenon, breakdancing, and this scene that's going on downtown, and these clubs, underground clubs. And I said, yeah, whatever. And then about 2 months later, the film Breakin' came out, which was a huge hit. You know, they made it for very little money, and it went out and did a ton of money in the box office. So, they thought I was a genius after that. They said, what else you got? You know, and I didn't have anything. And I said, well, there's these two guys that sort of want to become video directors, and they get odd jobs, and they get involved in this scams and this and that. And they gave us some money to start writing it. We started writing it, and then two other writers, Ryan Rowe and Jim Hirschfeld. And Jim went on to write many films. One of the biggest hits is Meet the Parents. And then Ryan went off and did also like other films like Charlie's Angels. But we started on Tapeheads. And then once I took Tapeheads to, it was a little different. Then I took Tapeheads to Pete. Pete said, hey, you know what? We should just do this about what you do, which is, you know, music videos. So make them revolve around more about the world that you're in, which is the music video world. I didn't really try to do the film based on my life, so to speak. Things just crept in. You know, how much actually ended up being based on my real situation. There certainly was a few. I mean, we certainly did some of those ones on SPAC, and I think that the production value line is probably real. A lot of the other lines came from other things that were real. You know, I think Let's Get Into Trouble, Baby was something that, like, Tom Mount said it to us in a meeting, stole from an executive that said it to us. So there's a lot of stuff that's came from real life, but I don't know how much of it actually is attributed to the actual situations that they're in. You know, they've kind of morphed. I moved around quite a bit of stuff and came up with a lot of stuff myself because the real stuff, it was far more ridiculous. No one would have believed it. The things that really happened were far too extreme to put in the film, so a little watered down, but some of the events are, so I think it helped when you're directing your first film to write about what you know.
Peter McCarthy.
He had like a kind of a short script or some kind of thing that a treatment or something that he had worked on with some other people. And I said, it's good, but you know, you really need like a script that's going to grab people before we can bring it to anybody. And we start working on one. It took us quite a while, but we came up with a script. And first person I thought to who I knew had connection to money was Nesmith, and showed it to him. And like he optioned it within a week. I'd never sold anything as fast as Tape Heads. I mean, that was like zoom. People just thought it was timely because of MTV and because of Billy's success at videos. And also, you know, I had some success now with a couple films. You know, Brandon Tartikoff at NBC liked it, and he was starting a production company, and he and Nesmith had become buddies. And so the whole thing started really quickly, and they just loved the whole music theme of it and the video, you know, music video theme of it. And, you know, it was right at the right time.
Bill Fishman.
John and Tim, they had been in, Sure Thing, and they'd met, and they were doing a play at Tim's Actors Gang Theater, and Tim had gotten a hold of the script, casting somehow. They knocked on the door one day, and like, hey, we want to read for these roles, you know? They came in together. They came in as the opposite characters, though.
And we just improv the whole thing, and I set up a camera in the corner and taped that, and we got a lot just from that improv. It was pretty amazing. Just finding the swanky notes, you know, when you called me, I went over to my storage and I like pulled out this itinerary and was like, I remember this vaguely, but it was Billy and I going in search of the swanky modes, and we start off in L.A. taping Tyrone Davis, and then we go to Chicago and we do Joe Cotton and Junior Wells at the Checkered Board, and then we go, while we're in Chicago, we go and see Big Twist and Gene Daddy, Gene Barge, and then we head out to Dayton, Ohio, and we tape Dennis Edwards, and then from Ohio we go to Philadelphia, and we tape the OJs and Eddie LaVert and, you know, Walter Williams. I mean, that's like the first 3 days. This goes on and on, trying to find the swanky moats. And you know, I was thinking, like, God, the list of people that we had, from the Neville brothers and the Whispers and Curtis Mayfield and, you know, Bobby Womack and Lou Rawls and Benny King and Billy Preston and, you know, LT&T Braggs and Al Green. And I mean, it was just so many people that we wanted to see who we could put together, you know. John Edwards of the Spinners and Johnny Guitar Watson and even people like Isaac Hayes. And I mean, it was just unbelievable, the search that we did traveling around trying to find these people. In some ways, I wish I would have videotaped that. It would have been an amazing documentary. Sam Moore, like living in a motel room out in the valley. And Junior Walker, oh my God, what a trip. In my life, you know, he and I became sort of palsy. And he came and he would visit me in Venice every couple months. Whenever he came into L.A., he would come and visit me and we would hang out, bring me tapes and stuff. And what a character. And so funny. Just an amazing guy. And he always would drive up, and he had this, like, a Mercedes. He said, come out and see my Mercedes. And I come out and go, this is an old Mercedes. It was like a 1980. I go, what's so special about this? And he goes, oh, look at this, Peter. And he opened the trunk, and the trunk was like a welded tank. And I said, what the hell is that? And he goes, I can put 650 gallons of gas in my trunk. I never have to stop for gas, you know. He goes, I can drive cross country and back, you know, and never stop. Bob Rose produced a lot of the songs, and this guy Brian Adler wrote songs. There was so much music. Nigel Harrison from Blondie was our music supervisor. Amazing guy. Eric Barrett, who was an associate producer, and has gone on to become a music video producer. We used to have this whole list of Rata songs. Every week we would get a whole box full of songs from Eric, and we would rate them from 1 to 5, and it was like, you know, me, Billy, Nigel, and Eric, and then we'd total up the scores and see who liked what. And, I mean, there was just so much music.
Bill Fishman.
We tried to show John a lot of films to characters to use as touchstones for his performance, unlikable characters, so to speak. And I remember we watched Tony Curtis and Sweet Smell of Success. That's probably where he took most of his look and his motivation from.
Sean Penn had a film called The Falcon and the Snowman. I remember we watched him in that film at that time. Rupert Pupkin, of course, the king of comedy. We kind of looked at a few characters and really tried to get John into that mode. And we sent it to Dale Carnegie, of course, so that he could use all those buzzwords and get that sort of, you know, shameless self-promotion, captain of industry kind of vibe, but be, you know, completely pathetic at it, really. And I think that's why you're kind of charmed by him, because he's so inept. Tim and John love to improvise, and my main job was getting to try to say half the words that were on the page. So I think things ran kind of over on that. And then we had a lot of subplots that never made it into the movie. I shot a lot of stuff.
Peter McCarthy.
Our rough cuts on this film were like 4 hours long. And I can remember one of the big fights I had with Nesmith was he was saying, all right, you did your rough cut, you got all your chuckles, now go and, you know, make a cut that we can, you know, look at. So we went back to the cutting room, and Bill and I and Mondo Jenkins, we always sat in the cutting room together. I mean, we worked for like a month and we cut, and I went back and we screened it. It was like 3.5 hours. You know, we had cut like a half hour out of it.
I was like trimming frames off of shots.
And like Nesmith freaked. We can't have a 3.5 hour film. Are you crazy? And he and I like almost got into fisticuffs. We finally got it down, but it was so much material and so many gags and so many other characters. I wish we had a video of some of those old cuts, because it would be just fun to see them. We would project them, but we were so low budget. The idea of like, you know, doing a video transfer of a rough cut was like just too exorbitant. There were scenes with the, you know, they weren't the video aces. You know, they obviously our guys were the video aces, but there were these two other kind of, they're in the Roscoe video, and they're kind of chubby guys. They had a whole running thing, you know, that we totally cut out. I mean, they're not in it at all. Where they were like, you know, kind of the mentors to these guys, and so it was unbelievable just how truncated it became. We had to go for the fun, and you know, but a lot of lines got cut. A lot of stuff like between Josh and Belinda got cut, because there again, they had a number of scenes together much longer, you know, and there were even more scenes. You know, there's some very funny scenes, I think, between Samantha, Mary Crosby, and Ivan, you know, Johnny Cusack, but there was even more with them. And you kind of learn that as you, the more films you make, you realize all your subplots and sub-characters and whatnot, that they're great and fun to write, and they add a lot to a movie as far as when you're going to make it, understanding what's going on. But when it comes down to editing a movie, a lot of times you got to get back down to the essential. So I did a film, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and in that I played Weasel, and I had a guest scene in that was like 6 minutes long. Finally, Damon Wayans shoots me. You know, and the whole thing got cut. And there was another scene in that where John Cusack, okay, you know, said, oh, I'll do a cameo for you, Peter, and he came in, and he gets blown up. I mean, we put like 100 squibs on him and blew him up in this thing. But it took him so long with all the squibs and getting shot like 500 times that we ended up dropping that out. And I was like, oh, my God, here, John Cusack comes in and does a cameo and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and we cut it out. And for pacing-wise, it kind of stopped it. Just some scenes with Lee that never got in, you know, where they talk to them about how well they've done and that they followed their dreams. And it goes like, you guys must be rolling in dough. And then they go, yeah, we are, but we don't have any. And they end up borrowing money from them. And I mean, it was just, you know, more stuff, you know, and, you know, this whole idea of characters coming back in Repo Man, Xander Schloss, you know, we see him on a gurney in the hospital for like a split second. Just that kind of funny thing of these characters that I always like the idea of bringing characters back in some way, even though you don't explain what the hell it's all about. So the fact that Lee was their boss and now he comes back and he's their driver, I mean, that says something about life, doesn't it?
There was a whole subplot with Lucky Larry, which is where they bought their equipment on credit, and they would do these commercials on TV. I think they might have even done commercials. And they would wear these sort of white suits, and then you never knew why they were wearing these sort of white suits until you saw that Lucky Larry was actually played by Hervé Villechaize, wearing his little white suit, you know, from Fantasy Island, sort of. And so Hervé was in the film, but that whole subplot was cut. So, so the editing was a real process, as I remember.
You guys the video aces?
We'd like to talk to you.
Oh, who are you guys with? NBC? CBS? MCA?
No. FBI.
It's against the law to broadcast pornography. You boys should have read the Meese Commission reports before you tampered with the airwaves.
What?
You have the right to remain silent.
No way!
Remember what we did to Jello Biafra?
Help!
You know what's funny, too, is that when John and Tim started doing promotion for the film, there were a lot of situations where people were offended by them doing promotion. Like, there was actually an interview that they did in one of the Good Morning America. And I actually found this thing, like a memo to me and everybody who had anything to do with it. It said that they had shot the interview with Good Morning America with Joan London, that the show's producers were appalled by the unprofessional behavior of the boys and that they decided not to run the interview. And so in a way that, you know, these guys, you know, those characters that they had become, they had this enmity toward, you know, anything establishment, you know, and Menudo kind of stood for this. It was all about packaging. And there again, it went to, you know, the ability to package anything and sell it. You know, and so in a sense, when they started doing these media things like Good Morning America and whatnot, I almost feel like they stayed in character and they were kind of blowing people off the stage with their behavior and their kind of raucousness. And I think that might be a reason, too, why they don't want to go back and visit this time, you know, John and Tim, because, you know, they were raucous and they were funny. They just kind of went with it. They were making fun of the whole establishment.
Everybody loves Menudo.
We were making the film. It was going to be distributed by Dino De Laurentiis' company. And so we had all our meetings and everything was going with them. And as we're finishing the movie and starting to edit and sort of going to meetings there and trying to get our distribution plan together and whatnot, we noticed that there's like less and less people at this company. You know, desks are starting to be empty. We see people walking out with their, you know, filing cabinet boxes and things. And we're like, hey, is there a problem with this company? No. Don't worry. We're good. We just brought a new guy in from Gray Advertising who's heading up our distribution. It's going to be great. You know, we got all plans and influx of cash, and we're all good. Meanwhile, each time we see less and less people. And
as soon as we delivered it, his company went bankrupt. And so we kind of got caught up in the asset bankrupt thing, even though we had gotten no money from him, because it was in his vault. They kind of did a lockdown on his company. We just, the whole thing got tied up, you know, so we had to fight to get the film back, you know. It took months and months and months. And, I mean, it was just a total disaster. And it was just kind of funny. Funny, because here we had people like Nesmith and Brandon Tartikoff, you know, the head of NBC, and they couldn't get the film back. You know, it was like, you know, the whole bankruptcy court thing, they freeze everything to, you know, and slowly, you know, let things out. And when they realized that we really hadn't gotten any money from them, we had made all these, you know, we were making delivery to them and had gotten nothing, we finally got it back. And at that point, a smaller distribution company, Kerry Brokaw's company called Avenue Pictures, came in. They were kind of a specialty distributor. I think Tapeheads was a kind of raucous comedy youth film that they didn't quite get.
They were able to book, I think, 70 theaters throughout the country for the release, but they never were able to get any theaters in Boston or New York. So the 70 theaters were, you know, elsewhere. We went to a couple of film festivals with it before it was released. I mean, it had already been sold, but we went to the Toronto Film Festival and to Sundance Film Festival. And I remember the Toronto Film Festival, we had a screening, I think a midnight screening, and it was probably one of the best screenings ever. I mean, my brother was sitting next to Roger Ebert, and he was laughing so loud that he couldn't hear the lines in the film, and yeah, everyone really went nuts, and the film loved it. The distributor was there and said, you know, this, we got a hit on our hands. Let's double it up. Let's get twice as many theaters for next week, or in 2 weeks when the film was released. So their crack team went and tried to get as many theaters as they could. Turns out, you know, they could get 140 theaters, but still not New York and L.A. So it opened up, like, in 140 screens. As I remember, the screens, though, because it was such a rush to get more screens, a lot of times they would just get like two screens at the same Cineplex. So it was kind of a botched release in that way, you know. It came out, you know, quickly, and probably was out in theaters in a week or two. Then 6 months later, the album came out because it wasn't ready. They didn't even release the album until after the film was out of the theaters. Someone in Boston, about 6 months later, screened the film, because he'd seen it in a film festival, screened it in a midnight screening at the Nickelodeon there. The film was sold out and was a huge hit, and it got written up in the Boston Phoenix as one of the top 10 films of the year, but it had never played there. They were able to organize another release this time in New York and Boston. And I think it played. I think in Boston it ended up playing for 8 weeks.
It's funny because after the theatrical release and the soundtrack, Nesmith did all the video releases on his company, Pacific Arts. You know, he had the video rights. And that was one of the big problems with Tapeheads, is that all the rights were kind of broken up. So Island didn't have the video rights, so when they couldn't make money off of distribution, I mean, they wanted to bail quick, and you know, other people had the video rights, and they didn't want to spend money, like Nesmith, on distribution, because, you know, it was like, I'm going to promote it here, and, you know, Island had the record, you know, it was just, and other people had the foreign, and it was just this kind of bizarre situation where none of the rights owners worked together. It was very frustrating to me. You know, it was frustrating too because obviously all these films that I do are small films and you don't make a lot of money up front and you hope to make some money on the back end, and Tapeheads has been one I've never seen a penny on the back end.
I remember Blockbuster never carried it, you know? So that was sort of the big venue at the time. And seeing as how I've never gotten one sales report on the film, I have no idea, you know, how many copies were ever made or sold.
And we're back. You know, MTV went live August 1st, 1981, you know, a day that will always be burned in my memory when that came on the air in no target markets near me whatsoever. But I heard about it way back in the day. And the real world wouldn't be on the air for about another 4 years. So this is right when MTV was still playing music videos, which is a very strange concept for people these days to understand. There were no reality shows per se. You know, this is pre-Survivor, pre-Real World. So this is even pre-Beavis and Butthead that we're talking about. I mean, Beavis and Butthead was just about to hit the air. So this is when MTV pretty much sole thing was videos all the time, sometimes grouping videos by different shows. You know, you had your Headbangers Ball on Saturday night, you had your 120 minutes, I think, on Sunday night, or Yo MTV Raps going on all over the place with Fab Five Freddy, and then eventually Ed Love and Ed Lover and Dr. Dre, but not the Dr. Dre that we all know and love. This is the other Dr. Dre, so, which was really confusing. It was kind of like Julie Brown versus Downtown Julie Brown. So Josh and Ivan were still using top-of-the-line gear, 3/4 inch, of course, but the video camera was becoming more of a, you know, ubiquitous part of our world, and we're still like 3 years away from Rodney King beating, so the idea of videotape causing scandal was still a bit of a novelty. Thinking about it, I've yet again managed to choose a movie that was plagued with release problems. I really have a knack for that, and at least this one's available through Netflix Instant Watch and on DVD. Apparently, was released twice on DVD, which I didn't realize. That said, I'm curious how you guys first encountered this movie. Skiz?
Well, at the time, I was heavily involved in college radio, and I got a package in the mail from Thirsty Ear Productions, who had done a lot of special programming that they would send out to college radio stations, like radio shows, gossip, and new music and stuff. But this was a package that contained a press kit for the film, tape heads. It also included the soundtrack album on vinyl, and it included a special 12-inch that had on one side songs that didn't make the soundtrack album, and on the other side, a 22-minute radio special promoting this movie, Tapeheads. And I'd never heard of the movie. I can't say I ever saw an ad for it or ever noticed it in theaters, but the press kit caught my eye because this was another Michael Nesmith production, and I was a huge Repo Man fan. And scanning down the list of the cast, on paper, this movie was just made for me. All the cameos of people that I knew about that most people, you know, the mainstream at least, were not that interested in. Here they are, all were grouped into this one film. I said, I gotta see this movie. And of course, there was no way to see it. Even if we'd have run that special, there was no screenings in my town. So eventually, months later, maybe even a year later, a housemate of mine came home from the video store with this movie he'd never heard of, but the box looked interesting, and it was called Tapeheads, and my jaw dropped, and I was like, I gotta watch this. And I loved it.
I have two connections to the film, actually.
Go for it.
One, I was working in a video store right out of high school, probably before I got a high school lecture, so around 93, 94, and I saw the film on the shelf, got it from there. I was shocked and stunned to learn that I actually have a weird connection to it in the sense that my third cousin on my mom's side was the editor on the film, Mondo Jenkins.
Oh, okay.
So it worked out pretty good for me.
As both of you guys, independent video store, kind of a mom and pop going in there and saw it on the shelf and was just like, what is this? And yeah, again, you know, I'm ashamed to admit this because you're probably more intrigued by like, you know, seeing Lyle Alzado and some of the other cool people that make cameos in there. No, I'm just kidding. You're probably more intrigued by, you know, like Jello Biafra and some of those folks making cameos in the movie. Whereas I was very intrigued because I was a huge John Cusack fan. So I was a big fan of, you know, The Sure Thing and
Better Off Dead
and One Crazy Summer and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, saw this movie and I was like, oh God, a John Cusack movie I haven't seen before. So rented that and yeah, just was like, this movie completely speaks to me. Who were some of the cameos that caught your eye, Skiz?
You mentioned Jell-O already. Of course, Weird Al and Ted Nugent, Bob Forrest from Thelonious Monster, Steve Baders, at the time he was going by Steve Bader. In fact, all the Lords of the New Church play the Blinder Children, even though I think on the soundtrack album it's Steve Bader and the Zeros. I'm not sure if it's the same Zeros that the classic punk band. Xander Schloss from the Circle Jerks is the heavy metal fan. He was also Otto's best friend in Repo Man.
He's the guy that sings the 7-Up song, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
King Cotton. I sort of liked the Bone Daddies at the time. Oh, and of course, Susan Terrell from Forbidden Zone. How much better can it get? And don't forget Mary Crosby, Bing's daughter.
Really? I did not know that she was Bing's daughter. Oh, that's crazy.
When did Bing die? Because I can't imagine he enjoyed her role.
No, I can't imagine. But it had to be somewhere around that, because I think that's around the time that all those Bing Crosby used to beat his children kind of stories were coming out. I seem to remember when there was a Saturday Night Live skit where Theo joined the Crosby family instead of the Cosby family, and you just see this like disembodied hand with a cigar talking about how he's going to beat his children and all this kind of stuff. So it had to be somewhere right around the same time. I mean, if Malcolm Jamal Warner is on Saturday Night Live, you know that had to be around that time. So yeah, I was a big Clue Gulager fan, so I was very glad to see him in that. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. I'm hoping I am. And yeah, it was great to see Susan Tyrell in there, because I think I had seen Forbidden Zone by that time. And if I hadn't, I think I'd seen Andy Warhol's Bad. So it was very nice to see her in something else. I was like, who is this really loud woman?
I keep thinking of more cameos that I forgot about. Sam Moore and Junior Walker as the Swanky Modes.
You guys are missing a ton of cameos.
Okay.
Don Cornelius from Soul Train.
Don Cornelius
Love and Soul.
Awesome in that.
You guys are missing two really huge ones, which is Courtney Love is in the film.
Uncredited.
And, yep. And then Lee Ehrenberg, actually, from Freaked, because Lee Ehrenberg was part of the Actors Gang by then, so he's in there. And then you also have Dougie Fresh, the human beatbox.
Oh, yeah.
And also Martha Quinn is
Mike
in there.
Nesmith.
Mike Nesmith, Bobcat Goldthwait, and
Bobcat Goldthwait's he's credited as
Jack Cheese. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And then also there's a great cameo because they were friends with the writer, and that's two different scenes. The Roscoe Chicken and Waffle sequence has Dave and Steve Higgins, which the Higgins Boys and Gruber, which is the first show on Comedy Channel when it first launched.
Wow.
And those guys are writing for like Jimmy Kimmel now. So
was that the Comedy Channel that became Comedy Central, or was that
Correct.
Okay.
And Cy Richardson is the bartender.
Liked him. The scene in the bar is probably one of my favorite scenes. The whole backwards sign language alphabet without vowels. So
and the light bulb going off.
I love the light bulb going off, too.
Let's buy him a beer.
You need it.
Two more.
Sorry, guys. Brothers against drunk driving. They've been busting my ass.
You gotta perform a sobriety test.
All right. Close your eyes. Real tight. No peeking. Now recite the alphabet backwards. Skipping all the vowels. And give me the sign language for each letter as you pass by.
ZYXWVTSRQPNMLKJHGFDCB.
You pass. I get those beers face.
I think that was what really got me the first time I ever saw the film was when that happened. I just really was like, I don't know why. It was such a simple gag, but it just really did it for me.
Hey, Skiz, are you by chance doing the show with us today on Spec?
What's Spec?
Mike, why don't you answer that?
Yes, I am doing it on Spec.
Okay, good. Is Spec there with you?
Spec's upstairs. Spec, by the way, for those that don't get this joke, is the name of my cat, who some people think I named after Richard Speck, but I actually named her after Pee Wee Herman's dog.
That's what I was just going to say, but it would be a lot cooler if you did name it after Richard Speck.
Next cat.
Next cat, same name, different reason for naming her Speck. So it was nice to see Fishbone in this movie as well. You know, the music is really great. And I forget that after I watch this movie, I get that Ordinary Man song stuck in my head for about at least a month every time I watch this movie. So having watched it like 3 or 4 times to research for this episode, it's going through my head even right now as we speak.
That Audience for My Pain song. That does it. And the Bo Diddley song, the Surfer's Love Chant, both of those songs get stuck in my head.
Some of the songs are pretty rough, actually. There's something about the 80s and the synthesizer that kills a lot of people in the 80s. Like, you can take the best artists from the 80s, and you put that synthesizer, best artist of all time, put that synthesizer behind them, and it sucks. It doesn't matter.
Perfect example is Cube Square. That's Devo singing in Swedish.
Yeah, it's rough, because, you know, it's such a treat for me, because I'm a huge Stax fan, so to see Sam Moore in there, and I was praying even the first, well, probably the first time I saw it, because I didn't know then, but now I was, you know, begging that he would break out in Soul Man or something, and just, you know, it doesn't happen. So, and then Junior Walker, of course, from Detroit, Junior Walker and the All-Stars Motown. So, you know, the music, I'm not a fan of the music in the movie, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I'm just not.
I don't know how much of a fan I am of the Swanky Mode songs. I really enjoy the final concert. Some of the other songs, I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool. But apparently they did so much damn research on the songs. Like Catherine Hardwick, who is the production designer on this one, she went ahead and did like album covers for all of these different Swanky Modes albums and their music, like, you know, okay, well, this is, you know, 1964 when they first got together. This is 72 when they were doing like their protest music. This is, you know, era when they're doing, you know, their disco music and all this stuff. So apparently she did all of these things. I don't think they ever show them in the movie. Maybe they're in the background someplace. But yeah, there's like a ton of stuff. And apparently the songs that we hear throughout the movie also are reflected as to what era of the Swanky Modes we are. So Catherine Hardwick had worked with these guys before and went on to do a whole bunch of stuff, including apparently directing some movie called Twilight. It's apparently popular with the girls or something. So I have to ask you, Skiz, what are some of your favorite bits in the movie? I know we already talked about the light bulb stuff.
Just a lot of the small, I mean, there's so many, but there's little small gags that I always love every time I see. I forget about it, too, and then I'll watch it and be like, oh, yeah, the hitman and Josh's parents drive the exact same station wagon. Or after the music video awards, Josh and Ivan somehow are able to just reach off screen and grab beers while they're driving down the street.
I love that part. It took me like 3 times before I was finally able to see that. But then when I did, it's like, oh, my God, I love that part when he just reaches over.
And the video security guard, you know, when they end up having a party and the, you know, this guard projected on the screen in the background is dancing to the music as if he's actually there, even though he's supposed to be pre-recorded.
I love that.
Just great ideas.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff going on, and I never realized until I was watching it with the commentary on just how much stuff was going on in the background. And just like, you know, just, of course they have the production designer there, she's talking about all of the different set designs and stuff, and it's like, oh yeah, like, oh, in this scene, like, you know, look at all the orange barrels, like how many orange barrels there are in the scene, and, you know, look at the posters on the back wall and stuff. Like, when they're at the very end of the film, when Jello Biafra shows up, there's a Swanky Modes poster on the wall right next to him. It's just like, wow, this is great stuff. There's just so many things going on in this movie and so many jokes that are being kind of layered on here and there. And yeah, it's just a fascinating film. So
I like when the girl in the music video says, teach me to read.
Sign my butt.
It's been, no, it's an awesome. Come on, let's try again. You sabotage, man.
This is just standing. I put my butt on the line for you guys, and you blew it.
Fix it, not editing, you're right.
Forget it, you suck.
Oh, I'm in this town. This is silent.
Are you guys famous?
How do I look?
Hey, we're changing lights.
Sign my butt. Teach me to read.
I'm in.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340 KAB.
I'll be coming for her, and I'll be coming for you too.
Sure you will, and I'll be waiting.
You are about to enter a world unlike any you've ever seen before, where rock and roll is king. The only law is a loaded gun. Where the beautiful...
Stay and see the show, it's really good.
The brutal...
I want Tom Cody.
And the brave all meet.
From now on, it's for real.
In Streets of Fire.
You're lying in your bed and on a Saturday night. You're sweating buckets and it's not even hard. But your brain has got the message and it's sending it out to every nerve and every muscle you got. You got so many dreams that you don't know where to put them, so you better turn a few. Your body's got a feeling that it's starting to rust. You better rev it up and put it to use. And I don't know how I ever thought that I could make it all alone. When you only make it better, and it better be tonight. I'll be there for you tonight. And if you don't have anywhere to go, you go down on the pedal and you're ready to roll. Even if you don't have anywhere to go, you go down.
From the creators of 48 Hours, Universal Pictures presents Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, and Amy Madigan in a Walter Hill film, Streets of Fire.
So that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening to another fabulous episode of The Projection Booth. Be sure to check us out on iTunes or via this here newfangled smartphone app, Stitcher. Download the app via the Androids or iTunes store. Or hey, just go ahead and listen to us via our website, projection-booth.com. Be sure to tune in next week when we enter into another Walter Hill world with Streets of Fire. And this week we're going to leave you with some Swanky Modes.
Any ordinary
friends. Check this out. Hold on a minute. Don't leave yet. Rascals in credits are your best bet. Them video aces went from rags to riches. Now they're in the can with no cash or bitches. When they serve their time, them suckers will see. Scores done expanded vertically. Tapers of the world, take a tip from me. You do what you gotta, but don't do it for free. Wings and waffles was just a start. Now I'm making more money than Norman Mars.
Menudo.